The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Impracel up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome, Voltron fans. This is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast, in this, the 30th anniversary year of Voltron, 2014. Right now, I'm going to hand off the reins of this part of the podcast to a man who originally started the podcast with me, my original co-host, Mr. Jeremy Corey.
That's right. JC, back in the Castle of Lions here. So super stoked to be on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast here with you, Mark, as we've got a very special guest who was involved in the original production of Voltron, now that we're on Voltron's 30th anniversary year here. Mark, how's your 30th Voltron 30 been so far as we reach the halfway point here in June?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm really stoked because we've had several members of the original production team now. We've had Franklin Kofod, we've had Mark Handler, and now we have another one who was the associate producer of Voltron, Defender of the Universe, back in 1984.
That's right. John Teichman is going to be joining us a little later in the show, and he's going to give us his lion-eyed view into all the action and the phenomenal series that is and was Voltron Defender of the Universe. So he's got some really interesting stories. But what else is going on as far as housekeeping and breaking news? I've been certainly following at Voltron on Twitter, keeping up with everything Mike's doing on the Facebook page. I see there's, you know, new coffee mugs. I see jerseys are on sale. Lots of stuff to get excited about. The Robotech Voltron comic book continues to amaze. Bob has been sharing some early issue things that are coming out. And just Elmer DeMaso and Tommy Yoon are just killing it on the Robotech Voltron from Dynamite Comics. So fans, if you want to see that original flavor, that original manga, and from what I understand, really kind of the first time Voltron has sort of returned to that manga state, please check that series out on Comixology or at your local comic book store, preferred. Have you been keeping up on that, Mark?
Yes, I have. I have the first three issues, and so far the whole thing is great. I've been reading it with my son, and we're both enjoying it very much. We know that issue 4 will be coming out later this month, around June 25th, I think.
That's awesome. So be sure to set your calendar alerts now, Voltron fans, because that's some crazy stuff. But I've been having a real retro summer so far. I actually sprung for the Nintendo Wii U with Mario Kart 8 in it. Have you heard of this thing?
Yeah, in fact, that's funny you say that, because we did exactly the same thing.
I'm enjoying the heck out of it. In fact, right before we jumped on here, I went on the Nintendo eShop, and the game that really kind of sold me was that NES Remix 2,
right?
With all those cool 8-bit things. I noticed there's another game on there called 1001 Spikes that looks pretty awesome and retro-licious. So I bet Voltron fans are, in fact, retro gaming fans. So I highly recommend picking up a Wii U, playing some Mario Kart 8. I was doing it with my 6-year-old boy. He was loving it. It was easy enough to play. And then get on there and download some NES Remix, some 1001 Spikes, and get your retro on here as we celebrate Voltron's 30th. What better summer to do it?
Right. And we're anxiously awaiting... I'm sorry, what was that?
You have like an old phone? What was that?
Who was that?
Who's got the old telephone there? That's what's great. It's probably John Teichman. He's probably calling from like a payphone.
Okay.
Something. He's probably calling from the bat phone. I respect anyone who has the old school ringer. So if that wasn't you, Mark.
That wasn't me.
And it wasn't me, then it must be our special guest, ladies and gentlemen, original associate producer of Voltron Defender of the Universe, John Teichman. John, how the heck are you, man?
It was me. Sorry about that. Trying to figure out how to shut it off.
That's how you make an entrance. That's the official sound when you're on a podcast and you want them to hurry up and stop talking about Mario Kart and talk to you. You have this phone ring. It probably came out of his iPhone, by the way.
It did, but just a warning, just stepping in here. Glad to be here, Mark.
Thanks for joining us, John.
And Jeremy, my old friend.
That's right. That's right. We've John and I have rocked a couple panels together before. We had a great one at Wizard World, 2 years ago, filled the room. Everybody was super excited just to be within cologne smelling distance of someone who had worked on the original series.
It blew me away. I couldn't believe the fans. You know, I had no idea that they held such esteem for the guys that had crawled around back in 83 and 84 and put it together. But it was a lot of fun. I loved the fans. I loved their questions.
Yeah.
These guys are true fans, and that's why it's still around, I guess, 30 years later. Yeah.
And you have an interesting story, and we'll just jump right into it, of you recall calling Ted Koppler up in like 94. And so, you know, early versions of the internet had fan sites on it. And you guys had just a kind of a funny conversation about, you know, should this thing come back or not? And he seemed like at the time to really feel like, you know, it had its time. This is now we're moving on. But can you talk about that a little bit? I always love that one.
Yeah, it was funny. I'd started a company with one of the Bush family. We called it Bush Productions International. I'm sitting down there in Florida, and I just had some lazy time in my big stupid office. Started looking around in Voltron, and I started seeing all these sites, and especially a lot of fans from all over the place that were still pretty fired up about Voltron. So I gave Ted a call. I said, you know, did you ever think about this? I mean, Voltron's still got some stuff out there. He says, John, I'm kind of trying to stroke my feathers. You know, it was a great time for all of us. It was really a wonderful ride. It was a fine show. I'm afraid it's just finally cruising out. And I said, I think you should take a look at these sites. These sites show quite a bit of interest that there's this many people still calling in about it. Think about it. So I think he went on from there and took it to Cartoon Network, and it started up again.
Yeah, with Voltron the Third Dimension. Yeah, probably a couple years later. I can only imagine all the Voltron Angel Fire sites. Actually, I've seen those. There's a lot of them, as you know, Mark. And
yep.
I'm trying to remember all the names of them. And they're still out there, the GeoCities and kind of Angel Fire ones and you know, Planet Doom and kind of the villain theme sites. So that's awesome, John. So let's start at the beginning, if we could, Mark. Tell us how you got wrangled into the Voltron mythos here.
I've got to go back a little bit, like about 1980 or maybe a little before. It all came through KPLR, one of Ted and his father Harold's stations, the other one being KRBK Sacramento. But I had come up to produce or post-produce a show in their facility there in St. Louis, which was actually 26 half hours of country western potty jubilee opera, you know, that was produced out of Springfield. So when I came up there, I met Peter Keefe, but I also met Hal Prater, who at that time was Ted's general manager, and he said, if you're going to do this show here and we're going to put it on, you're going to buy the production equipment and the rolling trucks out of us. So he's a pretty hard guy to say no to. And we also wanted that station. We were trying to clear a lot of stations. So I went down with some guys from KPLR and ended up coming back up to St. Louis. Peter Keefe had been part of a company that the namesake of World Events, it was called the World Events. And he was doing international documentary work. And we got together, and we'd have drinks over at Culpeper's at the corner of Maryland and Euclid. And I took off after we'd just gotten to be pretty good friends and went sailing for about 6 months in the Med and ended up going from Bodrum, Turkey to the Persian Gulf with the manager of Reuters News Service. Offered me a job. I was all signed up to take the dust covers off of a big studio there and go back for a minimum six-month contract. When I got back to St. Louis to get ready, I just thought, I don't want to do that. And so the more Peter talked to me about it, at first I said, you're nuts. We can't produce a kid's show out of St. Louis. It's not going to happen. I said, well, we're looking through some tapes now. We'll find out. So we went through tapes after tapes. It was Ted's idea. He just wanted some programming, you know, basically for the two stations. He thought he'd make it an economical decision, and we'd see what we could do with it later. Ended up syndicating it. But that's how I met Peter Keefe. We had a lot of fun in the beginning. We sat in a giant Chase apartment. He put one desk on one end. I put one on the other. I think there were two fireplaces. And we shot rubber bands at each other and talked about what we could do with these tapes that were coming in. We looked at a lot of different tapes. I still got a big wooden box full of giant 3/4-inch tapes from Japan from different companies. But anyway, we finally settled on one out of all the catalog. We ended up getting Go Lion instead of what we had ordered and loved it. And went to work with it. You know, I'm not sure, but the first pilot may have been the vehicle Voltron. You could ask Frank about that. But we just marched out there. Peter went first. I followed. We looked for a lot of people that we thought could handle this. And I think we really found our balance when we found Frank Kofod. because he had a lot of good connections. He was a really solid producer. You know, everybody respected him, and he got a lot of things done. I think if we hadn't had Frank, we probably would have drowned out there. through Frank, we met Jameson Brewer, who had been, I believe, the screenplay writer for Fantasia way back with Disney. And he had really been around. I mean, I used to go out to his house. I got to play the bad cop for Peter and go out when we were behind on schedule. He had six writers, six timers. We had a translator. And when he was starting to get behind, we started getting scared because we had to uplink five shows every week down by UCLA at Wold Satellite. So it was getting pretty scary there for a while. They didn't pull the trigger right away, so we were really under the gun when we finally realized after syndicating it successfully that we were going to have to do this thing. Mm-hmm. So I can't say enough about Frank and the success of the thing through his friends Paul Vitello and Jameson Brewer and Mark Handler was a perfect balanced genius. He did so well. I mean, all those people came together. All those forces came together, a real balanced bunch. I mean, there were probably another 150 people through all the subs working on it in different sound studios, SSI and Paul Vitello's studio that we built up, and the Foley stages, which I used to drop by once in a while. It's a lot of fun pounding on car hoods in sync with the giant screen, you know, to make sound effects and mumbling and crowds and such. That was a blast. That was really a hoot. Some of the girls did the side voices and sound effects in there also had side jobs, you know, in some other films that are not so well accepted. But they were a lot of fun. They had big parties, and we had parties with them, and it was a good time. I think in Mark Handler, we found a writer. These guys did a great job. I got to say, Jameson Brewer pretty much thought up sort of the characterization of all the people, you know, and I think that's still one of the powers today, is that there are different personalities that all come together to make the one thing. You know, their lions are all equally as powerful. They come together as one force. But unlike a Transformers, you know, there's actually somebody in there. You're not talking to a Camaro. And I think that's the basic difference, and a lot of people identify with that, and that's what's given it its longevity.
Well, John, I need to know something here, having listened to you. Most importantly, who won the rubber band wars between you and Peter Keefe in The Office? Who was the better shot?
Nobody, but I was better at painting on the television while it was running. You know, I remember that.
Wow.
Painting mustaches and different things, different creative things on every show we saw. We kept the TV on.
So you invented the iPad in all of this, but just couldn't quite get everything together on it. But
well, as John Nagy learned to draw, actually. You know, I learned it as a kid because you'd put a piece of plastic on the TV and draw with him. Well, we just drew right on the TV.
Yeah. What was that show called? It was like Mr. Something?
Somebody? I think it was John Nagy learned to draw, but I'm not positive.
Oh, okay.
There was a kid's
version of it. Fair enough. So, you know, that's so cool. You were out on the front line there in L.A. seeing all the production. When we asked this of all the original crew, when did you know it was a hit? When did you know, wait a minute, we have something here? I know you guys were so entrenched in it, as Kofod says. It's like you'd kind of hear something about it or kids talking about it in the neighborhood. When did you know it was a hit?
Well, first of all, we were under the gun, and at that time, shows were not launched particularly by the ad budgets, so people had to like it, and that gets down to the sale of the thing. We had the hottest GMs and program directors from the hottest cities, the biggest cities, come on a yacht out to NATPE, National Association of Television Program Execs, and to beat up Paramount and all these other companies that were having parties as well. We rented a big yacht and took them over to Sausalito and had the Casa Madrona with a French chef and got them all drunk and watching the pilot, and they all bought it. But we didn't realize it was going to be popular. We just thought, well, this is great. We're going to make enough money on the barter, which is basically trading the show for some time that you then resell, to make the show work. We're going to be able to do that. We didn't think a thing about licensing, and nobody ever did. And one day I was up at Premore in all the hundreds and hundreds of hours in there, stretching mouth flaps and all the stuff we did up there. Basically, it was a pretty tough job. There were a lot of people, not just me, involved, of course, in there. But I spent a lot of hours there, and I got a call because I think Peter was out of town, and I get this call from a guy named Victor Temkin. And it's kind of like the caricature of a movie exec. He goes, "Hi, Johnny, congratulations on your show. You know, it's the ratings are fantastic, through the roof. You know, I want to talk to you about licensing." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "Well, we have licensing all over the world. We do publications, toys. We have a lot of connections through MCA Universal, it was called at the time. They said, well, I'd love to talk to you, but I'm really busy right now. I'm up here at Primor Studios. He said, I'm coming over there. I said, well, really, I mean, we're right in the middle of a session. We're under the gun on this stuff, and I really don't know if I can. He said, I'm coming. So he just walked into the editing booth, and I knew it was business when there were like several of the guys in suits and ties and about seven people in there, each from different ends of the licensing business or different products. And they sat down and started to negotiate. And I didn't know what I was doing. I said, well, you know, what do we get? We'll take 10% of the gross. I know about the black hole of accounting, you know, in the studio.
Right.
So we'll take 10% of the gross sales. And he goes, oh, Johnny, you're killing me, you know. So we ended up with a good deal. I won't say what it was something less than that. But later on he told me at one of the parties, he said, you know, you almost blew it there, kid. We almost walked out. That's the best deal we've ever cut in a long time.
Hey, there you go.
So, it was kind of interesting to play that. And he was quite a character. You know, he came when we had the licensee parties down. We had up down at the Four Seasons. And at that time, they owned Resort Air, Ted and his father.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm coming in from St. Louis, from L.A., St. Louis. And these are basically booked by all our guys from the toy companies. And then they're looking out the window at the Ozark saying, I see an outhouse down there. Where are we going? Where are they taking us? You know, so we ended up landing down there, and we had a big three-day deal licensing where we talked about the possibilities and what some of the limitations were, and that we were making up what we call the Voltron Bible to make sure there was some continuity throughout all the different toys and toy companies, and had a blast.
Hey, John, was there any products in particular that you guys were going to say definitely no to?
I can't talk about them on the air.
Oh.
No. I mean, we had talking toothbrushes and wallpaper and publications and everything you could imagine, but I can't think. There may be one I don't know about that you guys know about that was foreboding, but I don't know what it is. Unless it was a decapitation device or something. Was pretty strict rules on children's programming back then. It caused us a lot of pain, but basically because the Japanese, as anybody out there knows, traveling the world, there are different sensibilities outside of this country, and sometimes the Japanese have different sensibilities about violence, bloodletting, sexual content, etc. So we had to be pretty careful when we cannibalized some of these early episodes from Toei Company. That it took a lot of planning as well, I might say, and that's probably thanks a great deal to Jameson and Frank Kofod, because they were, even though we did some of it later on, Peter and I toward the end of the process, they looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is unusable. 20 minutes of this show are unusable. You know, we can maybe use some of this in some other episodes. So that took a lot of jostling and intelligence to do that. And we had a lot of fun with it, too. I mean, the voice sessions were incredible. Sometimes Peter and I'd get all the work they had done, and Frank did a great job in the voice studios, because these guys are pros. I think we hired some of the best people in the country at that time, or maybe ever still. But they basically were pros, and they wanted to say it in a certain way, you know, with a certain lilt and a certain personality. And if it wasn't written for the mouth movements, it caused a whole chain reaction, you know, whereby they would try to get it, they'd have to change the script on the spot maybe sometimes, or maybe they would get it all the way into the editing booth, and we'd see that it wasn't going to fit, and we'd have to either stretch the length of the mouth flaps or shorten them, depending on the situation. And also that depended, or the possibility depended, on what kind of background action was going, because you can't just chop a whole thing, you know. And we didn't have the CGI capabilities we do now. I mean, that would just be nothing now. But we literally had to come up with ways that hadn't been done before to make them fit and look believable. You know, and I think that was part of it. There's a lot of stuff that probably goes unnoticed, you know, in all those details that everybody took care of. I mean, Dale Shacker was an amazing guy in audio. Peterson did some incredible music. I can't take away from that. And I like the full orchestration. It just takes you back to Star Wars and the whole feeling of an expanded reality. I think that really had a lot to do with it. But Dale Shacker's audio and Paul Vitello's manipulation of all the work is something that people don't realize. But I think it's more than 50% of the success of the show. Because when you see that thing, when you saw that pilot rocking out in stereo, I might add, in front of these people at the Casa Madrona in San Francisco, they just got blown away. And a lot of people do, too. I think kids do, you know, after school. It's a call to action and thought. And it's a call to a way of being that they ascribe to and like to be a part of. So I would never want to underestimate the sound and the music and the editing of the sound and the music. I think that is a huge part of it.
Absolutely, I think, Franklin Kofod had cited that as well, just how produced it was, and then that really made a difference among the kids' landscape.
Yeah, Peter and I often commented, and I think everybody else was of the same ilk, or same mind, that sound was often underestimated, but that it was really probably at least 50% of the impression of the audience. And right. all the rest goes together in the genre of the story and the flow of the story to make it something. But the sound was really incredible, and I think that was a big part of the sales success and the audience rating success. On the other hand, I can't take away from the Japanese either. I mean, if you look at that concept and all the others that come before and after, it's got everything. You know, it's classic, back to the princess and the castle, and it's modernistic because it's basically five mechanical lions that you get inside and drive yourself. So that gives everybody identity with it. And then there was also something that's sort of unspoken that I think is the big factor that kept it around so long, and I think that is that I stated it before that all the different personalities come together to act as one, and each person has some shortcomings and each person has some strengths, but they all come together. So I just wanted to say that I think that's a big part of the success, and that if they make this movie, I'm hoping they think about that, because it's great to have some incredible effects, and I like to go watch those things too.
John, what do you mean? If they make that movie, aren't you producing the movie? Come on.
Well, it's a secret, yeah. No, I did deal some with Ryan Cavanaugh and Relativity Media, but now Classic Media has been bought by DreamWorks, and DreamWorks is basically Disney, and they've got a lot of money, and I think they're pretty excited about it. And I feel for the first time that I can see some real momentum. You know, if you got a company like that behind you, I'm speaking out to you guys up there at Burbank right now. just remember what made it so successful and made it everybody from kids in the college student union to four-year-olds write in about it.
Well, I think that would be one of my dreams was always to do Albagos with the original production team.
Me too.
Yeah, Voltron, Lost Universe, and just bring it all together. Can you talk about, do you have any specific memories of the whole Albagos and why a pilot wasn't even produced, or just what do you
Well, you know, we had a hit on our hands, and we were lucky to have a hit on our hands. We're lucky to have the production team we got together. I mean, Jameson Brewer told me in the beginning, he said, you know, you got some great people here, but you guys can't just walk in here and write checks and be successful. This is Hollywood, you know, but we did it. And I think it's had a lot to say about the team out there and the theme from Toei and keeping it all together and the sound effects again. But Albagos was just sort of an extra. You know, I've always wanted to do it too. I think it's fantastic. You know, the animation is not like the new stuff. You can't have the same kind of flexibility, and it's just completely different. But I think some of the classic animation can work again. You know, witness Voltron. I mean, people still love that old stuff. They're basically hooked on it to some degree. I mean, I've talked to guys your age, you know, that are fanatics, and they're not even associated with the business. So Albagos would work. You know, it just needs to get that kind of a team together again. Hope to God, not that kind of pressure, but get that kind of team together that where everybody cares about their addition to the success and the total, and it would work. I mean, people would love it. You guys out there, take a look at it. Take a look at it.
Yeah.
Mark Handler already said that he'd love to do it.
Yeah,
I know. We talked about it. I talked to him about, I guess, when I was with Coppola, we talked about it a little bit. He would be fantastic at the helm of the writers, you know.
Sounds like we need to just Kickstarter this and bring DreamWorks the idea and the money, and here you go. I think, yeah, it would be great just like on a Netflix, even something like that. So, but anyway, do you remember season two? I mean, just the animation done in Korea, and just what were your memories of that? Because I know, you know, to play devil's advocate, it was pretty rushed, and we always noticed a quality drop on later episodes. I mean, I think the writing that you guys were able to open up and, you know, bring back Sven and introduce fan favorites like Merla. What do you recall on just when, you know, World Events had to start producing the animation from scratch?
Well, one of the things I remember is that here it comes. It's like a train coming down. What are we going to do? We started calling over to Toei Company, and we found out that the animation, a lot of it was actually drawn in South Korea. And we found out that since it was actually out in 81 and the artists were long gone, some of them, you know, we couldn't find them. So to duplicate the line quality and everything was quite a deal. You know, people, a certain artist has a certain line quality. I've still got some of the cells on Lotor, some things that just show how much work they put into it. And to find another guy after the original artist is gone to replicate it precisely is almost impossible. So I was not connected with that. And Peter was doing a lot of the searching and pounding the street throughout the world to get that done. But I do remember it was a big problem when we were worried about the line quality and, you know, whether or not it would match the old show. So mm-hmm. It was tough, and it wasn't something we could get around easily.
So I want to go back to the first time that you first saw an edited version of an episode. I know you had seen the pilot, and you said a lot of people were blown away by that. But for you personally, what was it like seeing the first full episode done and how it actually turned out?
Well, when you see a lot of the parts come together, like you're visiting the Foley, you're watching the editing, you're reading through the scripts and the translations before Jameson gets them, you're looking at the timing, you see all the pieces, it's kind of hard to see the whole show. So you don't know if you're successful or not. You don't get to see it for the first time. There's no first time. You've watched every little piece come together. So, you know, it's not like some actor that's done a million takes to make a movie and has never seen the other parts of it. We all saw all the parts. So I'd say it's pretty hard to have a first impression, but it's pretty satisfying, you know, when you get anything done, whether it's a documentary or a TV series, you get something done, you get an award, maybe you get popularity. You can't help but, you know, blow up a little bit and feel good about it. And then especially when it was successful, we had no idea it's going to be successful. But I can't say that there was a time when I suddenly realized it. Like maybe when Victor Temkin walked in, I thought, well, this is good. But not the first episode that I saw finished. And I think Frank and those guys did the pilot before I ever saw it. I mean, I didn't see it till we got to Nappy. Or maybe I did. I can't remember. But anyway, to see it presented in a big room with a lot of really important execs that can make it or break it, who we applied quite well with liquor.
There's the lesson, kids. Forget film school. Just invest in a massive party.
And the sound was so kick-ass. I mean, we had stereo for the first time, but I was thinking, Peter, this is too loud. You're going to break their glasses. It was really loud and really colorful, and they couldn't ignore it. And they all just bought it on the spot, just boom, boom, boom. And, of course, if the big cities like New York, L.A., Chicago start to fall in line, you got the first 10, everybody else says, what are they buying? You know, and it's sort of like copycat all the way on down through the smaller markets, through the hundreds market. So it wasn't very difficult. It wasn't very difficult. But I can't say to your question when I actually saw the whole thing come together, because there were so many pieces and because we were really up against the wall. I mean, nobody had time to sit around and gloat or anything. We were really working hard, everybody.
Of the products that were developed, which was the first one that you got to have on your desk?
Well, I had the big metal die-cast thing, you know.
Oh, you did?
I think I had one of the knockoffs. I think they sold illegally at the back door or something, about 400,000 Goliaths that first Christmas before Ted and the guys got the Marshall raid against everybody and basically closed them all down. You know, they were ready to go. They realized what they had in the United States. So, you know, we had everything. I didn't save everything I wish I had. Now I can't afford to buy them all. But I can sign all my own. I signed one for a guy here in the West End in St. Louis, and he said, thanks, you just doubled the collectible value of this. Just to have somebody from the original team scratch on it, you know. So I think that's pretty interesting. I wish I'd kept a lot of the pieces. I wish I had more right now. I still got an old watch. Like I say, I've got some cells. That's pretty interesting, original cells.
The cells, I don't know. Those would be amazing. Yeah, those are kind of tough to find. I know some of our forum fans have been able to track them down, but that's fantastic. Now, John, having got to know you over the years, and you have a very wide variety of interests, from sailing to traveling to, you know, metal music and such. Where did the post-Voltron path lead you? Were you involved at all in Saber Rider and the Star Sheriffs or Denver the Last Dinosaur, any of that stuff?
What was
the next chapter for you?
I basically split off because I wanted to do the live-action thing, a la Power Rangers, but that was, of course, before Power Rangers, and I really wanted to get that done, and I worked very hard. I got a big advertising budget together from Matchbox. I had a whole group of the executives from the U.S. in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, I think it was. Lived in Westport, Connecticut, traveled back and forth to the toy company, and basically got it together, and then we didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. we're drinking up at a bar in Westport. We said, well, we got to find out what's going on. And the CEO or the president of the U.S., his name was Jack Daniels. And we tried to call Jack several times, didn't get him. We finally found out that the whole United States and the whole Western force of executives had been decapitated by the company in Hong Kong. So with that, we lost that. And I think, like I said, Saban was prowling around the booths at Nappy, and while I'm eating fish sticks with the Japanese talking about the possibilities, I was listening around the corner. I never met him, and the guy's obviously a genius, and he pulled it off. But I wish I'd been gone on that trip. Since then, I started the Bush Productions later on. I did a bunch of development work for Warner Brothers.
Documentaries?
No, that was kind of rockumentaries, Peter called them, because in the beginning we did it for Turner, and we needed to get basically something that put us on the map because we were a new company. He'd been out making very expensive home videos up in Churchill, Manitoba with his kids and said, well, if I'm going to spend $150,000, $200,000 having myself filmed on my family, what can I make out of it? So I knew him from St. Louis and knew his sister, and we got together and said, well, you've got to have a connection, so let's go for this Yellowstone Wolves reintroduction thing because the impact more crews may cause, there's only going to be one crew. We flew to Washington. We got the contract. We got awards for the film. We shot the reintroduction of the Yellowstone Wolves. It put us on the path. We did wildlife adventures for them, and later on similar stuff, basically the same. Celebrity adventures for Warner Brothers. A lot of time in between. Like you said, I like sailing and traveling, so I'm a traveler. Where I have a bad resume, nothing there for a couple of years. I didn't care. Now I'm in development with Fremantle and a cooperation between the Explorers Club, which I'm a fellow out of New York, and the Fremantle Media in Burbank to do a series of expedition films, which basically mixes all of my loves and passions together, making television. And I think we're partnering up with a guy named David Holbrook, who's the director of Mountain Film and Telluride, to create an expedition, an adventure film festival in Manhattan. So that's taken up quite a bit of my time and very interesting to me to see that go, but Albegas is always on my shoulder.
And the fans as well. So tell us just some about, did you keep up with the Saber Rider and the Star Sheriffs? Were there early rumblings of, you know, when the success of Voltron did, what was going to be next?
Yeah, I think everybody was pretty high on the success. I remember Ted and his accountant guy came out to Century City and said, whatever you want, the sky's the limit. Make some more, do some more, you know. But there was a lot of chefs in the kitchen at that time, you know. Starting out from just the two of us and kind of building it up through Peter and Frank out west, that was a tough situation but a comfortable situation. Then we started having people come in, you know, that wanted to be a part of our force who really just wanted to jump on at a fast train, which was already going. And I didn't like that. You know, we had several guys that came in and took over us. You know, and I didn't like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I sort of said, okay, time for another Grecian trip or something. You know, I'm like, took a little sabbatical and kept working on the what we called Road Warriors at the time, was working title. It kind of morphed into Power Rangers. But I kind of got out of kids after that. I did work for Anheuser-Busch Company Intervision just because I had some experience later on. They did some kids' self-help shows. Animated here in L.A. and artists and writers in Northern California. But that was more soft stuff, you know. It's not my true love, like no spinning laser blades and no laser beams, you know. So I drifted back into what I started with, working at PBS and doing documentary work, basically, when I did the thing with Turner and Peter Bush. He was the head of that. So we had some success, won some awards, had some fun. But, you know, it was like for somebody that's not in production, he used to call it, this is like a Chinese fire drill every day, especially when you're being successful. There's lawsuits and people trying to knock you off. We had the same thing with Voltron, you know. It's a lot more than meets the eye. So for some people, it's not an easy life, you know, and sometimes you need a sabbatical to get away from it. But basically, I loved it, and I don't mind, you know, all the fast things coming at you and changing quickly. So I wanted to keep in it. It's just, unless you start a business and you got your name on a plaque and you're constantly calling for business and living in L.A., basically, is what needs to be done almost, to schmooze and talk to other people in the industry, you're going to drift out of it. That's kind of what I did. So after a while, you do what you want to do. And like I said, my passion now is travel, expeditions, Explorers Club, and doing something that's a little bit different. Maybe it's not the reality mode totally, and maybe it's not the total documentary mode, but it's sort of reality documentary expeditions.
So right.
That's how I steered my life, basically. Not
and
an
of
easy
course,
route.
Mark, John, and I do have something in common that we both married lovely Colombian women as well.
Oh, really?
Yes. Caramba. Ay, caramba.
Ay, caramba. Yeah. He knows all the Colombian things from the aguardientes to the Carlos Vives and things like that. So when we get together, it's often to talk about the quirks of living the modern family life, as it were, except for real life.
Yeah, it's a culture clash and a wonderful thing at the same time. I lived there 3 years. I went through on a layover on the way to Buenos Aires, and I just fell in love with the town of Medellin, the city of Medellin. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And went back and ended up living there 3 years, meeting her and getting married and moving back to the States to do more production.
Yeah, not a bad act two in all this. So I understand, Mark, we've got some listener questions that may have been posted we could go through.
We had asked for questions from the fans, as we usually do, and this time we got a few, and I'd like to start with Mark Oliver.
The invincible Mark Oliver.
Mark Oliver asks, in the selection process of the trilogy, were there any other anime that you talked about that may have taken the place of Daltanius, or were the three shows set in stone from the beginning? Did you have a B plan?
I think Peter had a B plan, because after I looked at all the things we had in the beginning and I saw the path I went down, but he was always thinking ahead. He was pretty good at thinking, well, like I said, here comes a train wreck if we don't do something about this. So he probably did consider some other things but didn't discuss it with me. And I can't answer the question efficiently. I don't know. Like I said, I still have a box full of other shows. But, you know, Mark Oliver probably know better than I do, because he's an aficionado fan, what went on back then. I just can't help him. I might be able to steer him to somebody that could. But
can you talk more about the Road Warriors project that you mentioned? Do you remember what specific show it would was it like Kamen Rider or something, or what would it have been?
No, I've got – oh, my God. I can't even remember the names of them in Japanese. But, you know, there was one that was all motorcycles.
Mm-hmm. I would have liked that one.
Rocket motorcycles and ninja stuff to boot. And then there's some of them that had huge, like, like Godzilla inflated figures that went to war, you know. Looked like really corny stuff. But, you know, I thought, well, the kids would like this. It's really nuts, you know. And in the end, they blow up the monster. And I don't know if that was part of it. But there was probably about a dozen of them. I've still got a lot of those. I'll look them up if you want for a future reference.
I think
people to look at, you know, maybe we'll do one of those, man. I'd love to do something like that.
Yeah.
Just have fun with it. But I would say that Saban did a really good job of making a transition. That's a much more sophisticated show than the things I was looking at. I just like the action, you know. It's every show is basically kung fu, you know, kung fu fighting. And they did a lot of triple flips and jumping through the air and shooting lasers and fireworks. I just said, wow, this stuff's fantastic. I mean, you don't have to think too hard about it or you won't like it. But if you just watch it, you're going to want to watch it.
Just taking a team of Bruce Lees and turning them into superheroes.
Yeah, sort of. But they were all kids, you know, like the Voltron team.
Right.
They were all kids inside there. And some of them had like metallic masks that would just come down when they're going to battle, like zzz, zzz, zzz. And others were just themselves. But, you know, there were all kinds of different characters. And I always thought, you know, like they've basically done, is you could pull a lot of international characters from different countries, pull them together under the auspices of a worldwide team or a universal team, and get a little bit of everybody in there. They'd have to be great actors, because it's not animation, but or at least passable, but it would be good. And I think that kind of thing could still be done, and people would love it if it's written well. Mark Handler. Calling Mark Handler.
We're just going to do it. We'll call it the Unauthorized Voltron spinoff.
Well, I think the next question by Amanda Kress. Would you be interested in working on another Voltron series if you were able to? It sounds like Albagos fits right into there, right?
Well, I think we pretty well discussed it. You're right.
Yep.
I think I would. I would love it. I'd love to be a part of it. And I got to stress that it's not just me, and it's not just Frank, and it's not just Peter. All those people have to come together and really want it, and I think they would. And I think Jeremy would be a great fireball and come in the middle of it and do it for us.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, now that in the unauthorized section, it's nothing scandalous or revealing, is that I did have direct talks when I was at World Events with Toei about, you know, Albagas. And it was funny that when I first reached out to them, they said, well, don't you guys have the rights? At which point I should have said, yes, of course. I was just moving along here, and then just, you know, when did it? But you know, had to be upfront and be like, no, this was actually, as Ted tells, it was exchanged. Go Line was exchanged. You know, when they were going to do Deltanius, Dairugger, and Albagas, and then needed Go Line because they only had three shows. So that was sort of the best official explanation. But we had talked, and it came close to just, you know, again making the economics work. But I think if, you know, you could have got a Netflix or something to pick it up. So who knows? There's a lot of great Voltron fans like SvenBlue 2000 who are doing their own fan projects with it. So it still could be something.
It's possible
really
if we
cool.
get the right political and high level context. It's a lot different right now than it was when we walked in and syndicated in a 20x20 booth, you know, and pulled everything together and pulled people that were in media sales and TV stations to come in and sell on the floor at NATBE. You know, that world doesn't really exist like that anymore. You almost need to align yourself with a big distributor and a lot of money and a toy company.
Yes, always important toy companies.
There's a lot of fans like myself going out onto Crunchyroll and looking at the original Go Lion series and seeing all the differences there were between the original and the Voltron series. And I'm just, you know, going back to what you had said about this team that they had brought together that did such a terrific job making Voltron with the sound and with the music and with the voice acting and everything. It's just so much of a big difference between what you're watching on Go Line and what you're watching on Voltron. And it's just an amazing transformation.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm sure all the guys do too, because that's what we put and poured our hearts into. But it was something good to start with, I got to tell you. You know, the Japanese have some good ideas. Now, we can't have Princess Allura's bikini top plopping off and all those other things that were in their version, but, you know, they got the basics.
You know, it's been 30 years since Voltron came out. When you used to describe Voltron to somebody who didn't know what Voltron was back then, is it different from how you describe it to somebody now?
I don't think so.
Somebody who hasn't heard of Voltron.
I always say the easiest translation for me to somebody that hadn't heard of it, I just say it's five mechanical lions that form together with individuals inside. And if you don't want to ask any questions from there, I don't continue.
Okay.
That's awesome. So what else? Yeah, lots of exciting things going on in the world of Voltron. And John, you've been awesome for the insights to just what it was like back in the day. And hopefully all of our dreams can become realized and we can see some of that what if stuff with an Albagas series or something Voltron related, as we hopefully we'll hear some more news around Comic-Con towards any new Voltron entertainment.
Yeah, I'd like to go to Comic-Con again. I really love the fans, and I just love being around them. I love their enthusiasm, and you know, I'm gonna try to get out to the big one and meet people and sign things and have fun with them. You know,
you do. You need your own little booth.
I am my own little booth, and I'd like to send out to all the fans. Email me if you want. You know, I'd love to hear from you. It's just johnteichman@msn.com.
Can you spell your last name and just the first one too?
Well, it's in the credits, but johnteichman@msn.com. So I know it's a long, weird name, but it's mine.
We'll take it. And you're right, so right about the fans, and they're the ones we have to thank for keeping all of this alive. And Mark, I understand we're closing in on 10,000 views?
Yes, we are. This is it's a wonderful thing. Our next episode after John Teichman's episode is going to be an actual interview with Ted Koppler, the creator of Voltron.
Nice.
So we are anxiously awaiting that, because at the same time that episode airs, we will be hitting our 10,000th view. And we had a special contest that we started up, and we're giving out 10 Voltron prize packs to 10 lucky listeners of the podcast. So we're looking forward to being able to read some of the comments that people had said to thank Ted Koppler for bringing us Voltron all those years ago.
I got to say this too. I mean, if Ted hadn't fought and fought hard to get this done, it wouldn't have happened. There were powers against him, and he stood up to it and made it happen, or we would have not had the money or the wherewithal to get it done.
And there's some kind of a hashtag that I don't know if it's TED10 or 10TED or Voltron10K, something there with that's awesome that TED is going to bring home the 10,000 listeners.
That's right.
Yeah, you guys listen to him. He's the man.
Right.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Anyone who wants to see what I'm up to lately, which, Mark, I'm sure you've seen some of the goofy stuff that we've done in a kind of the 80s throwback commercial.
I saw you in a Mr. Incredible costume.
Yes. You know, just another Saturday running. John knows about that. Yeah, it was a marathon for the Cool Fire Hollywood Hustle 5K, and my family went as the Incredibles, though the Elastigirl costume came hours later, so my wife had to sort of improvise a Wonder Woman / Mrs. Incredible. So I like to say that's Mr. Incredible's second wife. You know, he went through the midlife crisis, got the upgrade, and so that was he went with Wonder Woman.
You can always save that as a collector's item. That's going to be something that nobody else has.
That was the mistress or whatnot. But we're doing some fun stuff. Follow me on Twitter at Jeremy Corey, JeremyCorray, if you want to see what we're up to at my position at Cool Fire. We're creating some fun things. We did a series of bacon videos. Who can disagree with bacon? With Kerry Keegan, actually. That's the Voltron tie-in there. Kerry Keegan, who, as we know, is probably the ultimate Princess Allura cosplay. She came into town and we did a series for Farmland Bacon Club for us. So you can see what happens when Princess Allura meets a full bacon wedding dress and creates the legendary Bacon Bierstein. So just go to farmlandbaconclub.com there. So there's a Bacon Club post plug.
Plenty of fans of bacon out there. I know that.
Yes, bacon and Princess Allura, can't beat it. If only they had a Robies made of bacon. Then that would be the ultimate mashup here. So I've gone down a total verbal vortex here, so I better stop.
All right. Well, John, we want to thank you for joining us on the Let's Voltron podcast, and we want to thank you for all that work you did for Voltron and World Events 30 years ago. That was an incredible piece of work.
It was fun. And you fans, write me. I'm lonely out here.
John, what are you talking about? We'll have to hit Anime St. Louis or Archon or one of these places, and we'll be sure to hit the tequila bar beforehand so we can loosen up for the panel.
Definitely, well, dude. Dial me up.
I personally want to thank you for helping me when I interviewed you for the book that's coming out later this year by Viz Media, the Voltron 30th Anniversary book. I want to thank you for all the information you gave towards that. So thank you.
Hey, you're so welcome. I'm so excited to be a part of it. It's amazing that it's still racing around the universe.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to the Ted Koppler next episode. That's going to be huge.
Right.
Yeah, you guys, everybody listening to him, he's the man.
All right.
He's the man.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Jeremy, for joining me again.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to check back into the universe of Voltron. Happy birthday, Voltron, Voltron 30.
So that's going to do it for this week on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. We're looking forward to our next episode where we'll get our 10,000th view and we'll be able to talk to the man who originally brought Voltron over from Japan, Mr. Ted Koppler, the president and CEO of World Events Productions. All right, we will join you next week on
Let's Voltron!